Next week, Thursday after, following, immediately following the class, there'll be another of the Lonergan Research Institute seminars upstairs in classroom E for anyone who's interested in coming. And this time, the presenter will be Danny Mansour, who's on the staff of the Lonergan Research Institute. And his paper is not quite finished yet. We've been bugging him about it. In fact, Robin Koning came in yesterday and said, "Mansour, where's your paper?" And Danny said, "It's not ready yet. It's a mess," he said. "Well, it won't be a mess. It'll be very good." It does very kind of a... His title is "The Harmonious Continuation of the Actual Order of This Universe in God's Self-Communication," which translated means "The Relationship of Nature and Grace." Or the general and special categories of theology. General categories studying nature, special categories studying grace. That's one of Danny's big interests. And he's done a lot of very detailed and deep work on these issues. And I look forward to reading the paper and to being a commentator following it. So that's next Thursday, November 13th, at 4:15 in Classroom E. And then once again, and this is the last time you'll probably be invited, but we know you know about the event tomorrow. And it's shaping up. It's going to be great. It's really shaping up. We're getting all ready for it. And social hour beginning at 4. Come and stay as long as you want. There's the slide presentation around 5 o'clock. And lecture on grace and friendship by Fred Lawrence in the evening. And I think both of those presentations are going to be terrific. So I invite you just to come. I think it's going to be a wonderful day. On the MP3s, I have been neglecting each week to tell you what's relevant. And I'm still getting used to lecturing, knowing that you've also got the opportunity to listen to Lonergan talking about his own book. And so I have to get used to that. But the MP3 for August the 7th. The material on common sense. Last week, August 7th, part 1, down to track 39, is relevant to the material that we saw last week, and particularly on the whole notion of common sense as a development of insight. He doesn't go that much into the dramatic bias in this lecture. And anyway, that's relevant to last week, to chapter six of Insight. And August 7th, part 1, 39 to the end, and part 2, tracks 1 down to 22, and somewhere in track 22. That's relevant to what we're taking this week. This is chapter 7. And then August 7th, part 2, track 22 to the end, is relevant to what we will see next week, chapter 8. So that's where we are in terms of the corresponding comments by Lonergan on the book. And then Greg says that he's ready to take orders for another MP3 anytime now, and they'll be ready next week for another 4 days of Lonergan's lectures, and that basically covers the material on judgment, reflective understanding, self-affirmation, being, and objectivity. I've been hearing and I know that he covers all of that. Those are central chapters of the book, and they're really the hinge chapters of the book, so it would be very helpful, I think, to hear Lonergan talking about the material in those chapters. So if you're interested in another MP3, you just see Greg at the break or after the class. We'll have them ready for us next week. Okay. We're going to be using today both some material from the end of the notes on chapter 6, and then the, I can find the notes on chapter 6 here somewhere. Yeah, there they are. And then moving into the new notes on chapter 7. So on chapter six, what we saw last week, I think, can be broken down or summarized in 4 points. Number one, the general notion of common sense as a different kind of development from science. Common sense development is the development of our capacity for insight in the realm of the particular, in the concrete. Common sense is common to the members of various communities, but it will be different from one community to another, from one culture to another. There will be a different number of similarities, of course, but also a number of differences in how to live. What's the good way to live? And how do we relate to one another? What are our customs, our mores? That differs from one society to another, from one culture to another. But in every culture, there is this specialization that most people have. And when we say a person doesn't have any common sense, we mean that they don't function even according to the customs and the mores of the people that they live with. Now, that, under certain circumstances, may be a compliment, but nonetheless, we mean that there is a common way of doing things among various cultural and other types of communities, common sense particularities. For instance, as women come together, there are various specializations in the particular and the concrete that are being shared and developed, and they're formative of a community there. And workers and people in different fields of employment and so on and so forth. Its concern is the way things are related to us. Its knowledge is descriptive. It's not explanatory. But it's still knowledge. And it's complementary to science. Science is needed for the explanation of things according to their laws and so on and so forth. But common sense is needed to get through the work of every day. You can't cross a busy street in the intellectual pattern of experience. You won't get across. Got to move, you've got to shift into the relations of things to us. If you're interested in the relations of the cars to one another, you're not going to make it. The relations of the cars to you that's important to getting across the street. But that's knowledge. That's not appearance. That is knowing. Knowing that this car is getting very close. That's knowing. Okay, secondly, who are the we to whom common sense relates things? Who is the subject? Who are you? Who am I? There are subjective developments in the subject. We change over time. And these subjective developments were studied in chapter 6 under the rubric of patterns of experience. There's the biological pattern of experience, the aesthetic pattern of experience, the intellectual pattern of experience, the dramatic pattern of experience. We can move from one pattern to another depending upon our interests, our purposes, our direction. I can move in daily life from one of those to another. Last night, Peter Larissy was giving a demonstration of some of the artworks around here. Well, if you're in the biological or even the intellectual pattern of experience, you're not going to get much out of that. You've got to let go of that. And you just have to enter into, you have to let him tell you what that painting says, and then see if he can enter into what he's talking about. See if you agree. It's the aesthetics, the aesthetic pattern of experience. So a pattern of experience is an ordering of sensations, memories, images, emotions, bodily movements, intersubjective responses, depending on what I'm interested in. And I can shift from one pattern to another. Thirdly, the principal concern of the chapter of chapter 6 is the dramatic pattern of experience, the dramatic pattern of everyday living. And that pattern, this is the harder thing to grasp, but I think we got it last week. It's a function, first of all, of underlying neural demands for conscious representation. So there is in our nervous system, there's a surplus, the way that a lot of depth psychologists describe this, in our nervous system, there's a surplus of energy that can reach its fulfillment only by coming into consciousness through sensations, through feelings, through emotions, through images, and so on and so forth. That's where it achieves its finality, if we can use that kind of language. Conscious representation, a demand for conscious representation. And that meets up with the situation of our lives as that situation patterns our receptivity, our capacity to allow things into consciousness. So we're formed by the situation that we are born into, the family that we're raised in, the culture that we belong to, and so on and so forth. It sets up a readiness, or perhaps a resistance, to letting certain things into consciousness in the first place. And that perhaps there are certain things that we, because of traumatic experiences in our past, that we can't deal with. We gotta filter them out. We can't face them. And I would think that maybe that's the case in some instances with a lot of us. So the people that have been through a lot of tough things, they can't go to see certain movies, for instance, because it brings that back. They can't deal with it. And then they know that. Okay. It's better to stay away from that. But at any rate, there's a readiness or a resistance to allowing certain things to come in the form of image and affect, sensation, memories, and so on and so forth. And that's the dramatic pattern. It's a function of those two things, the situation as it molds our readiness or resistance, and the underlying neural demands that have to get into consciousness in some form or other. Okay, so there's a prior selecting and arranging of what we can deal with and what we will allow in. And the fourth point that we saw last week is that prior selecting and arranging can be dominated by a bias against allowing into consciousness what we need to get on with our lives. And that bias is what Lonergan calls in that chapter dramatic bias. As you know now from reading chapter 7, he will deal with other types of bias, individual, group, and general. But dramatic bias is the resistance that can be built into the censorship, resistance to allowing into consciousness, particularly the images, and we'll see that as we move on with this chapter today. The images that are needed for insight that will enable us to get on with our lives. We are patterned to exercise a censorship over the emergence of images and affects. And when that censorship is repressive of the images that are needed for insight, it's dominated by what he calls here a dramatic bias. A dramatic bias because it's a bias that affects the dramatic patterns of experience. And that dramatic bias is a function of two dimensions of the subject, both our intelligence and our psyche, sensitive psyche. The two of them collaborating together to resist. And the more the psychic is the source of the dramatic bias, the more the therapy must come from outside. The less capable we are dealing with it ourselves. And the more there must be a healing that comes from an external source, whether it's formal psychotherapy, whether it's finding somebody who loves you into freedom, or whatever it is, but there's something has to come to release the psychic dimension, and you can't do that for ourselves. It has to come from elsewhere. It can come from grace. But normally, grace is mediated through human communities of one form or another. So it has to be given to us. Freedom must be given. To the extent that the resistance is a function of psychic trauma, psychic hurt, whatever it might be. Because the psyche is not responsible for its own disorder. The psyche is, this is some of the development on this that I've tried to do in my own work. The psyche is not responsible for its own disorder. I may be responsible, but by the misuse of my freedom for psychic disorder. But the psyche itself is acted upon before it acts on its own. And so it needs to be released from its disorder through the agency of others, and it's only the agency of others that can do it. That can help and provide the situation in which perhaps I can take the initiative that I need to take to reach a state of psychic well-being. Okay, that's what we saw last week, and I'd like to resume with the notes from last week at number 19 on page 6. And we can go on from there and finish the material on chapter 6, I think within the next 15 minutes or so, and then we can go on into chapter 7. But I think these things are very important to cover because for many of us, this is where Lonergan starts to become existentially quite pertinent and relevant to our lives. And I know in my own experience, it was chapter 6 and particularly chapter 7, the one that we're moving into today, that convinced me that he was onto some very important ideas. So anyway, neural demand functions, number 19. They are inhibited from achieving psychic representation and conscious integration because of the bias. And that inhibition is different with respect to images from what it is with respect to affects. I think he's 100% right on this, and I think Freud and a lot of others who have learned from Freud would agree completely with what he's saying at this point. Lonergan's perspective is that insights arise not from the experience of affects, but from imaginative representations. That's straight Aristotelian Thomist doctrine, that understanding is into images, insight is into images. And so to prevent insights, repression will have to inhibit demands for images. On the other hand, it need inhibit affects only, the demands for affects, only if they are coupled with the undesired images. And here's where Freud would come in and I think say amen to what Lonergan is saying. Accordingly, the repression will not inhibit a demand for affects if that demand becomes detached from its apprehensive component, image or images, and slips along some association path and attaches itself to some other apprehensive component, image or images. So our affects can become disengaged from the images, the apprehensive components that they are normally associated with. They can become disengaged and they can slip along and they can become associated with something else. And so you have the displacement of affective cathexes, or whatever the language that psychologists use. It's displaced from its original, but it comes into consciousness as obsession with something else, or as fetish, or whatever. But it slips away from its original, and it moves over to some other apprehensive component, some other image, some other cognitively apprehended object. Inversely, when there emerges into consciousness an affect coupled with an incongruous object, then one can investigate association paths, argue from the incongruous to the initial object of the affect, and conclude that this combination of initial object and affect had been inhibited by a repression. Freud does that in his own way through dream analysis, and Jung did it in his way. He started it with through word association tests, when he came to see that very incongruous affects were associated with certain words. And then, this is the way he started his own adept psychology back in the early 1900s with these word association tests. He would give people words and ask them to say what immediately came to mind as an association with the word. And then to explore what is going on there. Well, in many cases, he would find, at least hypothesize, that the affect had become disengaged from an original image and was being attached to something else. And what was forming was a psychic complex that was inhibiting the person's well-being, and a psychic complex that was preventing things from coming into consciousness as they should, so that the person could develop a conclusion for their life. So what happens there is that the image is repressed completely, and the affects are very hard to repress. Feelings are hard to repress. There is no such thing as unconscious anger. You may be not cognizant of your anger, but if it's anger, it's conscious. But it may be attached to something that has no congruity with the feeling. The resultant division defeats one's efforts at a smooth performance in the drama of living, because there are feelings that are attached to objects that are incongruous with regard to them. Dreams can be helpful here because they can introduce images for insight that waking life represses. The censorship is more or less relaxed in dreams, although it can still be distorted. I just comment here that Lonergan's later treatment of dreams is more existential and, in my view, more satisfactory than the treatment in this chapter. And then in my own work, I tried to integrate some Freudian, some Jungian, and some existential emphases. And you can find that where I'm indicating there in the theology of the diagnosis of history. Well, it's a theory of dreams that's presented in chapter 9 that brings those three together. One possible. Anyway, the whole argument in this section, and this is important, I think, to realize, is not presenting a causal account of the origin of psychic trouble and of healing. Lonergan is not saying that psychic trouble is caused by running away from insight, nor is he saying that it is healed by insight. He's not saying that. It's caused by hurt. It's caused by abuse. It's caused by things that affect people's feelings. Okay? But what he's presenting is a functional correlation between the flight from understanding or the repression of insight. Insight can be repressed because you can't deal with it. All right? He's not attributing guilt or fault or blame or anything. But it can be repressed because I can't deal with that right now. There's something preconscious that just pushes it out. Right. So it's a functional correlation, and the fact that in the healing there will be an insight into, or a series of insights into, what caused the problem and how I can avoid falling into it again. That will be part of it. But it's a functional correlation, not a causal account that he's offering here. The cure involves the occurrence. It involves the occurrence, but it doesn't depend exclusively on the occurrence of at least the principal insights that were blocked, and their occurrence not in the intellectual pattern. And there can be somebody who can have the greatest and most correct psychological theory about his or her problems and still be a mess if it's all in the intellectual pattern of experience. They can sit with you and tell you, this is what's wrong with me, and this is why, and this is what my mother did to me, and this is what my father did to me, and this is what my older brother did to me, and blah, 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 blah. And they go on for hours. But it's all in this intellectual pattern. It's all detached from the dramatic pattern in which they live, and if that's the case, it doesn't do any good at all. So it has to be in the pattern of living that the insight occurs, because then it can have an effect on the pattern itself. And finally, in this chapter, there's the note on method with which he concludes. And the note on method here is indicative of Lonergan's procedure in dealing with many different figures and thinkers, and I think it's exemplary. It's exemplary, I think, particularly for, well, I found it exemplary in my own work, but I think it's exemplary for the church, and how the church should be. Lonergan's always ready to learn. Everybody read voraciously. The number of articles and books and so on that he quotes is astounding. But he was always learning from them. And if he had a disagreement, the first thing that he would do is advance what he found worthwhile. Move it forward. And then the rest of it can fall away. And that's what he's doing with Freud here. He's acknowledging, first of all, that there's a genuine discovery in Freud's work. And the discovery is psychogenic disease. There's disease that begins because of psychological trauma. Diseased human beings who are psychologically something has happened to them to hurt them. Not physical. It's not physical. It's psychic. Freud discovered psychogenic disease. All right, take that. That is a genuine discovery and move it forward. Advance the positions is what the language that he will use later on. Advance the positions. Push them for all they're worth. Develop them. And that's what he's doing with Freud here. Okay, Freud expressed his discovery in mechanist determinist language. No Christian theologian can agree with that. No, and Lonergan doesn't agree with that. He doesn't agree with the mechanist determinism that robs us of freedom and reduces us to the pure materiality and so on and so forth. But that does not remove the fact that he did discover psychogenic disease. And the present chapter may be viewed, Lonergan says, as pointing toward a methodologically more sound expression of that discovery, but it was Freud's discovery. And so this is the way he would put that methodologically more sound expression of the discovery. And this ties back now with the emergent probability of the first five chapters, especially chapter 4. If there is something non-systematic, if we can acknowledge the non-systematic in the universe of our experience, if we can acknowledge that. Now this I'm quoting this whole thing here because it's important for the rest of the book. Okay. Acknowledging the non-systematic leads to an affirmation of successive levels of scientific inquiry. So if you acknowledge the non-systematic, then you can acknowledge that there are successive and autonomous levels. So the non-systematic at the level of physics means that there are certain events that from the level of physics cannot be explained. But when those events start happening in schemes of recurrence, there has to be a law to explain them. And if they can't be explained on the level of physics, perhaps they can be explained on the level of chemistry. So the non-systematic is on the level of physics, in the metaphysical sense, is potency for the emergence of schemes. And schemes, in a metaphysical sense, will be form, right? But at a different level from the level of physics, at the level of chemical compounds. The non-systematic on the level of chemistry, there might be, for instance, individual instances of life that cannot be, that from the standpoint of chemical laws are non-systematic. Events, the emergence, living, okay, life. Okay. If that becomes recurrent, if life becomes recurrent, perhaps it can be explained on the level of biology or botany, vegetative life. From the level of botanical vegetative life, what if there's the occasional emergence of sensitive consciousness? Even in the extremely rudimentary form of sensitivity to touch or whatever, sensitive consciousness, which can't be explained by the laws of the body. But if it becomes systematic, if it starts to get schematic, it can be explained by laws of sensitive psychology. And then if from the standpoint of sensitive psychology, there occur such things as insights, and especially theoretical insights, judgments, profound free decisions of human beings, perhaps experiences of profound religious experiences of God and so on, which can't be explained from the standpoint of sensitive psychology. Well, maybe that gives rise, but if they become recurrent in people, if people are recurrently intelligent, reasonably responsible, and loving people, sensitive psychology can't explain that. Well, maybe it can be explained by a science and spirituality. A science of the spirit. So if you acknowledge the non-systematic, you're acknowledging the possibility of successive levels of scientific explanation. And that's what he wants to do here with Freud. Now, he doesn't set this all up in this chapter. It'll come in greater detail in chapter 8, on the notion of things. But he does give you enough of it here to indicate what how he would take Freud's discovery and move it into a context that gets away from the mechanist determinism that wants to reduce it all down to the level of physics. And Freud's early book, the project toward a scientific psychology, Freud said his ambition was to reduce all psychic phenomena to physical data. And Paul Ricoeur, in his great work on Freud, says that was the attempt to achieve the ridiculous. The physical is simply too narrow to hold the psychic data. But the genuine insight of Freud is not gainsaid by that. The genuine insight is psychogenic disease, but let's find a framework in which we can accept that, in which we can promote it, in which we can move that insight forward. So let's read that quote there from 229, 230. Robin, we're still in last week at the very end on page 7, number 22. An acknowledgement of the non-systematic leads to an affirmation of successive levels of scientific inquiry. In the non-systematic, if the non-systematic, I didn't notice that when I proofread this today, if the non-systematic exists on the level of physics, then on that level there are coincidental manifolds that can be systematized by a higher chemical level without violating any physical law. If the non-systematic exists on the level of chemistry, then on that level there are coincidental manifolds, instances of life, for instance, that's what he's getting at here. There are coincidental manifolds that can be systematized by a higher biological level without violating any chemical law. The non-systematic exists on the level of biology, and on that level there are coincidental manifolds, sensitive consciousness, that can be systematized by a higher psychic level without violating any biological law. If the non-systematic exists on the level of the psyche, insight, scientific theories, judgments of truth, major decisions, heroic decisions, and so on, that can't be explained by sensitive consciousness alone, then there are coincidental manifolds that can be systematized by a higher level of insight and reflection, deliberation and choice, without violating any law of the psyche. In brief, an acknowledgement of the non-systematic makes it possible to conceive, number one, psychic health as a harmonious unfolding of a process that moves at once on distinct yet related levels, physical, chemical, biological, psychic, spiritual. Secondly, psychic aberration as an orientation of the stream of consciousness in conflict with its function of systematizing underlying chemical, biological, neural manifolds. Something is preventing it from doing that, from bringing them into consciousness in their authentic fashion. And thirdly, analytic treatment, psychoanalysis, or whatever you want to call it, as an effort to reorientate an aberrant stream of consciousness and to effect a release from unconscious obstructions with a psychic origin, if they have a psychic origin. Now, the release will take place only if the psyche itself is affected. So he's not saying the release takes place through the communication of insight. The psyche itself has to be affected by whatever therapeutic agency might be working with a person. Again, another way of putting it, if you acknowledge, now he's anticipating in this paragraph his later theory of judgment, an acknowledgement that the real is the verified. So the real is what you verify. Right? If you can verify that something is, it is. And that if it is, it's real. But the real is the verified makes it possible to affirm the reality no less of the higher system than of the underlying manifold. So if the psychic is verified, if you can verify that certain traumatic experiences, for instance, in an individual's life have set that person on a course of
occurred to me, danger and so on and so forth, then that, if those judgments are true, then that is the real.
Right.
It makes it possible to affirm the reality no less of the higher system than of the underlying manifold. The chemical is as real as the physical. The biological as real as the chemical, the psychic as real as the biological, and insight as real as the psychic. Now, all of this is anticipating, if it's true that the real is the verified. He will argue that in detail a couple of chapters down the line. That once the psychogenic ceases to be merely a name, but the psychic becomes a real source of organization, not reducing it back down to physics and chemistry and so on. The psychic itself, the conscious, sensitive psyche, is a source of organization that controls underlying manifolds in a manner beyond the reach of their laws, the laws of the underlying manifolds. The psyche can organize, can integrate what otherwise remains coincidental from the standpoint of biology or chemistry. That's chapter 6. Let's pause and see where we are.
As we go on to the successive levels to meet questions of the non-systematic levels, I suppose the data that we use for verify will differ from levels to levels.
The data for
verification on each level. Like, for example, spirituality, it is not dealing with materiality, material data, empirical data, but it is empirical nevertheless.
It's not dealing with. I don't think I would want to say it's not dealing with empirical data. I mean, insight is an empirical data. You experience it. If you experience it, it's empirical.
That's what I mean.
So. But it's not dealing. It's not dealing only with sensations and associations at the sensitive level. But empirical, I think we have to. Lonergan, he's already used the expression generalized empirical method. That empirical method, as it functions in the natural sciences, is a matter of experience, understanding, and verification with regard to. The data of sense. But if we experience data of consciousness, that's a redundant phrase right there, but obviously we do, then you can have an analogous method that is a matter of experiencing, understanding, and affirming, the data of consciousness. So you can turn the method on itself if you want. And that's generalized empirical method. So that is empirical. So the data. Are data of sense. The data for physics are data of sense. The data for chemistry are data of sense. The data for biology are data of sense. The data for sensitive psychology are data of sense and of consciousness. And the data of spirituality are data of consciousness, by and large. Interiority, the realm of interiority.
This is a wondering in relation to some reflection on Eastern traditions, Buddhism, Zen, and if somewhere if there's a way that I can somehow say, well, that's a whole other approach, and here through insight we're looking at an intellectual scientific understanding, but it is said that. Deep meditation should not be undertaken by someone with a very fragile psyche, that through the process of meditation that there may arise much more than the person is ready for or can handle. Now then, but given that caveat that somewhere that there is a wholeness that comes through that discipline, through that commitment. So how is what we are calling psychic healing possibly to be situated or understood in our language, conversion healing that would happen, for example, in prolonged meditation?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of analogous things to what has been said here can be said about that, because I think immediately when you mentioned the thing of the caveat about deep meditation,
mm-hmm.
you only have the same caveat about analytical psychology. That, you know, and there was a student of mine at Marquette once when I was teaching a course on Jung and spirituality, and he asked, well, can't we hasten the process of individuation? And well, Jung was saying, you know, you can't hasten anything, because if you any kind of false playing around with this stuff is really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And any attempt to push it can lead to collapses rather than to health. You've got to let things emerge as they're ready, as you are ready to receive them,
mm-hmm.
and as they're ready to come forth. So there's that analogy that someone who himself was relatively attuned to a spiritual dimension. I don't agree with all of Jung's statements about God and spirituality by any means, but he was more attuned to that dimension of reality as real that Freud was. I mean, he was ready to admit God's existence and the existence of more than these sciences can explain. I'm much more ready to accept that. And he would have said the same thing about hastening the process that he was attempting to bring people through, that a Zen master would say. Now, I'm not an expert on Eastern meditation.
I just had heard it said that Lonergan's response to what is called the enlightenment experience, which is about shutting down the process of reflection and just concentrating on the moment of breath and position and so on, that somewhere those who would have achieved that enlightenment experience, that he said, well, I suppose that would be the equivalent then of what he has been called all the conversions. And so there were times when I was trying to perhaps see where the dialogue would be.
No, that may be true. That may really be true. I don't know if he said that or not.
No, I don't either.
I'm not sure that he did, but you know, I know that he.
I know the text, but there was no. It was almost reported.
He found the work of Bill Johnston, the Jesuit in Tokyo, to be very, very enlightening to himself. The sharing of the experiences of Zen monks and Christian monks coming together to meditate together and then sharing their experience together, being able to talk about it. So, and you know, if it's leading to self-transcendence, then it is doing the same thing that he's talking about when he speaks about conversion.
Mm-hmm.
And all the forms of conversion that he speaks about are promoting self-transcendence.
This is a language that we can.
It's a language for. It's a Western language. It's a language rooted in the Aristotelian Thomas tradition, but it is a language that we can use to talk about. Perhaps something very similar to what happens in some other religious traditions. In his paper, you know, a lot of stuff after method in theology, still needs to be explored. I want to do a course sometime on the post-method Lonergan, just to read the last. Except for the economics, I can't do the economics. I don't understand the economics. But the other things that he did after method in theology, because it's like Beethoven's last quartets. You know, it's like the everything is so sophisticated. You know, it's like the product of a whole lifetime. It just comes together in these little pieces of articles and so on. But he did. A thing for a conference in Vienna in 1975 on, it's called Prolegomena. It's a long, very long title. Prolegomena to the Study of the Emerging Religious Consciousness of Our Time. He says in there that, you know, something's happening as Johnston's monks are coming together and as these things are happening in other parts of the world. And we don't really have a language. And the language is only going to emerge as these people continue doing this and talking to each other. So the best I can do now is use the language that has been given to me by my own tradition to talk about what I think is happening here. That's what he goes on to do. But I think that part of what he's saying is that there is possibly something that's going to emerge in terms of insight into what, from our standpoint, what we will continue to call the grace of God at work in the world, as long as we stand in the Christian tradition, we'll stand and say that. I think it's going to be a matter of the development of pneumatology from a Christian standpoint, the theology of the Holy Spirit. But that doesn't mean that all of the other traditions are going to accept that theological interpretation of it. But I think that's where the major significant doctrinal developments of the 21st century are likely to occur, is in pneumatology, our understanding of it, and the universality of the mission. Fred Crowe has pointed us in that direction with his paper on modern and the dialogue of modern movements. But I think that's where it's headed.
Thank you.
All right, we're at 3 o'clock, so let's break and then we'll come back and we'll go to chapter 7 and we'll come back in 10 minutes.